You're listening to the I Love You Keep Going podcast with George Haas. For more information, please visit our website at www.metagroup.org. That's www.metagroup.org.
So welcome, everybody. This is I Love You Keep Going. It's August 3rd, 2023 at 7:35 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. And I thought that I would talk a little bit about view or mind states tonight. It's one of the things that we spend a lot of time focused on, recognizing a view or a mind state. View is the Buddhist word. And view really means this process of filtering ultimate reality when it's formed into conceptual reality. This Buddhist view is quite different than the Western view that we, those of us who grew up in the West, normally inhabit as a description of the way reality forms. Aristotle said that we tend to take in everything that's around us and create a working model internally and then operate from that working model. And that our perception of what's actually out there is largely accurate. And so that we all take in the perception of what's out there, and then we work from that model. And so that we have a shared sense of reality that is based on this system of human beings creating representations of what's there. We might call that the non-mentalizing mode of psychic equivalence, where you think that you've taken in and created an accurate picture of what's there, and that everybody else is doing the same thing, and that we're all operating from the same kind of perception of what's there. And so you can, in that sense, infer meaning to other people's actions based on your own internal model, and that those interpretations would largely be accurate. About 300 years later, Epicurus modified that a little bit and said that if you had a strong emotional state while going on, while you perceived what was happening, that that could have an effect on the working model, but that the working models were largely accurate. This is really very different from the Buddhist perspective on this. In the Buddhist perspective, mind gathers mind moments, and then we assemble the experience of conceptual reality from those mind moments. Because we're conditioned and we have preferences for what appeals to us and what is interesting to us, the mind does not do a systematic survey of what's out there, but it collects things based on our preference for them, and then assembles a sense of reality based on those preferences. So that if we go into an environment that's rich with objects or sense objects is what I mean, that we enjoy having or we have a preference for, then we think that the environment is rich. And if we go into an environment where there's an absence of those, that same group of sense objects, then we find the environment lacking. We have our limited capacity of sensing. So touching, seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, each of those sense gates, if there's an object available and there's contact, we have a sensing experience of them. And then the mind selects from those sensing experiences the qualities that we then roll into the reality that we're experiencing, which is largely based on the database of already experienced things. So we take in a sensing experience, which is raw, unattached, unfixated, undefined, and then it's compared to previously sensed experiences. And if we find a match that's close enough, then that meaning thread is attached to the experience of the present moment, and it unfolds from ultimate reality into conceptual reality. That is to say, we attach meaning to the sensing experience as it's unfolding in the present moment and create a reality based on what meaning we assign to it. Is that making sense? So there is no intrinsic meaning. There is what we give it. And in each moment, as we take in the sensing data, it's not a complete picture of what's happening, but just our highly curated selection of what appeals to us, our preferences. And then we take that edited group and form it into or fixate it into the experience of reality that we're having. So ultimate reality is the capacity to sense. So that's also based on our capacity to sense. It's interesting to be in an aging body because the sensing experience is quite different than it used to be. I went to the optometrist and she suggested that I consider giving up driving at night because of the state of my cataracts. She said that I should begin noticing that, particularly when headlights are in my eyes, that it'll interfere with seeing. I was already aware of this, and actually I've been aware of it for quite a long time and have limited that. But they're not so bad that she would recommend that I have the cataracts removed and lenses put in, which is what's happened to some people I know. My friend Vincent had one eye done at a time, and he said that when he had the contrast between what he was used to seeing and the new lens in his eyes, it was like one eye was sepia toned and one eye was technicolor, that he could open the technicolor eye and it looked completely different, and he could close it and open the sepia eye, and it looked like he was used to, but it was quite muted in comparison. And then he could open both eyes and the mind would merge them together in a quite interesting visual experience of the world. And then, of course, he had the other eye done, and it was back to technicolor, but that also didn't, the perception of it didn't last as well because the contrast was gone. So we get quite used to the change in our capacities to sense in the aging body, and don't necessarily notice how that affects the way that we experience self and world. We also can get into the habit of forming things because our selection is often an unconscious process. We may not notice what we're selecting in creating the experience of reality that we're having. And if we're relying exclusively on the database of the things that have happened to us or what we can imagine, then we tend to get into these habits of creation where over and over again we create the world in a similar way. I think the Buddhist word for that is samsara, these ruts that we get into, where the world just keeps in this automatic process of creating the same perception. Where, of course, we want to get to is where we, in each moment, are able to experience all of the possibilities, all of the choices that are in front of us, and then to choose the ones that really resonate to us in a deliberate way rather than falling into this cycle of picking over and over again from the same limited palette. We do a lot of work with attachment around here, and most of the time, the people that come to do attachment works are the ones who had had adverse childhood experiences, because people who had, good enough childhoods don't need to do the work, and so they don't come. Only makes sense. But what we want to begin to understand in that automatic conditioned response to things is that reality that we're creating is based on that database of things that we've experienced. And so if we grew up in an environment where we didn't matter that much, where our preferences didn't matter that much, over and over again, we create the sense of ourselves and of the world where we don't matter much and our preferences don't matter much. And it's insidious in the way that infects or is the basis, maybe that's a better way of describing it, the very fabric, the very basis of the way that we make this conceptual reality that we experience has those preferences built into them. And when we don't pay attention and we simply allow the process to unfold automatically, it's very convincing that that's what is true. And so we need to begin to interrupt this, to see in each moment all of the possibilities that are there, and then begin to choose in an intentional way how we're going to make this experience of self and world. In between ultimate reality, which is the pure sensing data, we say ultimate reality. I think it's rather comical in the sense that what we mean by that is our sensing experiences. And because we're living in human bodies and our sensing experiences are our sensing apparatus is constantly degrading, as you live longer and longer, the quality of that ultimate reality changes quite a bit. But then that ultimate reality is compared to the perceptual database. And if there's meaning, of course, then that meaning attaches and it rolls into conceptual reality. And that's what we experience it as the conscious self experience. It is often possible to have experiences in the present moment where there is no corresponding entry in the database. And so then our imagination then kicks in to create a meaning that's associated. I tend to be somebody who likes to have unique experiences, and so I notice that my mind engages the imagination quite a bit to understand what's happening because I don't have history about what's happening. And that's appealing to me, but some people don't like that. And then also, what you may notice is that there's conditioning around the capacity to imagine. One of the things that happens in childhood, particularly in adverse childhood experiences, is that we stop allowing ourselves to imagine the things that we want that we can't get because it's too painful to imagine them. I call it pinching off the imagination. So that in adult life, when we enter into an experience that's unique, that we don't have a readily available entry in the database, and we need to imagine what that meaning is for us, and we've pinched off our imagination so we don't allow ourselves those experiences, or we don't allow ourselves to imagine those experiences, we can get into an aversive relationship with moving into territories that we don't already know well because of the discomfort of pushing up against the limits to our imagination. It's too painful. And then that can have an adverse effect on our exploration and how we are willing to pursue the things that we find fulfilling and meaningful. So part of this is to push up against those limitations in imagination and get them to open up so that we can be more effective in the way that we explore this precious human life. So, if there's an entry in the database, or if we can imagine what the meaning is for us, we attach that to the ultimate reality, the pure sensing data, and fixate it into the experience that we're having. And in between that ultimate reality experience and conceptual reality is where the views of the mind states live. And they have a tendency to distort the perception of ultimate reality as it's made into conceptual reality. The Buddha described this as the reflection of light off the surface of a bowl of water, which was a mirror 2,600 years ago. The metaphor is that we don't experience reality directly. We experience it as a reflection off the surface of the mind. So if you use that metaphor where the surface of the bowl of water is the surface of the mind, and the mind is equanimous, the water is still and clear, the perception of what's happening that's reflected off the surface of it tends to be pretty accurate. In the way that we can know something, right? We have the sensing capacities of our human bodies, which we use to create the experiences that we have. But it's quite a limited apparatus. You know, the spectrum of light is vast and we can know only a sliver of it. The spectrum of sound is vast, but we can only know a sliver of it. The spectrum of temperature is vast, but we can only inhabit a sliver of it. So we really do operate with this very limited capacity to perceive things and create the experiences that we have based on that, which is not to say that it's a complete experience or even close to that, or that we even can detect everything that's happening around us. We can't. The Buddha said, if the mind is filled with lust, such a good word, lust, the mind is filled with craving, if it's filled with the desire, it's as if the water were dyed a bright color. And so that the reflection on the surface of the water is infused with this bright color, but you can't really tell that that's the way it is. It's like the technicolor eye versus the sepia eye. Without the contrast, it's very hard to know what's happening. The experience of conceptual reality is infused with these bright colors. I think that we mostly, most all of us have had the experience of being infatuated and how the experience of the other person looks through the lens of infatuation, and that when the lens of infatuation is pulled, how that changes the perception of the person. It's a funny thing, this human condition, where you can go from being enamored and being in love with somebody and a relatively short time later being filled with animosity and hatred for the same person, as if they were somehow different than they always were. Or is it simply the view that changes? The Buddha said that if the mind were filled with hatred or aversion, it was as if the surface of the water were boiling. Have you ever tried to see the reflection of something off the surface of a boiling pot of water? It's completely impossible, distorted, different than it would be. The mind is filled with restlessness and agitation. It's as if a breeze were blowing across the surface of the body, distorting. The mind was filled with sloth and torpor, as if algae had overgrown the water. The mind is filled with skeptical doubt. It's as if the water were muddied. Those are the hindrances, the classic teachings. When we were in Myanmar with Sayadaw Indika, he asked us to add to that the view of loving kindness, the view of metta mind, to understand that when you hold that view of loving kindness, it changes the perception of conceptual reality and everything looks different. It took a while to figure that out. He would say, metta mind or loving kindness mind is always cool, always kind. When I try to describe it, I say always cool, always kind, open, friendly, curious. It's inclining toward someone. It's not passive. So it's lively, it's active. When we say cool, what we mean is an absence of the heat of desire, an absence of the heat of anger that arises from frustrated desire. When we say kind, what we mean is a generous consideration and assistance for somebody without the expectation of return, open and absence of the heat of rejection, friendly, a helpful, affectionate, non-harming stance, and curious, an eagerness to find out about another person, lively, energetic, not detached, instead fully engaged in what's happening. So imagine that filter lens falling between ultimate reality and conceptual reality, what that experience would be like and how the world would appear. When we were in Myanmar, the Sayadaw said that he was giving us a break so that we could get up late. And what that meant was that we needed to be in the meditation hall at 4:30 a.m. instead of 3:30, and that we would sit. And so the first few days, maybe the first week of the retreat, people got more and more frustrated in attempting to understand what a mind state was or a view was and how to hold it. And then that stomping around and the slamming of doors and the frustration that was evident would transform suddenly, and then they'd be in a blissful state, floating almost. I asked the Sayadaw about it, and he said that he called it a meta bomb. That when you finally figured out what a mind state was, what a view was, and you developed agency to be able to cause a particular view to arise and sustain awareness of it, it changed everything. I like to add to this conversation the understanding of the attachment view. When the attachment system activates, can you recognize the way that that changes your perception of self and world and the drivers that it engages? The seeking of proximity to somebody who you think of as safe. There's three of these modes of attachment. One is the attachment system, which when activated causes you to come back toward people who will protect you, who you feel safe with. The second aspect is the collaboration system, the drive to go out into the world and discover the things that you need to know so that you find fulfillment in this life. That the third system is this collaborative relationship system. Can you recognize when you're in an equanimous state of mind? Can you recognize when you're holding a particular view or mind state and how that distorts the perception of what's happening? And do you have agency to change an afflictive mind state to a beneficial mind state? Or to just hold an equanimous mind where you're really just experiencing things as they unfold? Do you understand the virtue of holding a particular view and how the way that it inclines conceptual reality may make it easier to function in relationship to other people in a way that's beneficial both to you and to other people? Edward?
Yeah, what just comes to mind is I rescued this orange tomcat who's intact, and not this white one behind me, but this orange one, and I'm going to get him fixed, if, you know, at a price somewhere if I can. But anyway, he sometimes just caterwauls at night, you know, and other times, I mean, and And I also, and I just can't, and I want to keep the windows open more because it's cooler, but he gets out to get, you know, to carouse and chugle. But anyway, my point is just that last night he was doing this howling or whatever it is a lot. And I was, you know, half asleep and it was muggy and I just, but I was just listening to it and I was just feeling this tolerance, you know, it's like, I was feeling, you know, I'm not going to get up and try to put him in the bathroom. I don't know if it would work, you know, I don't know what to do, but I'm just going to, you know, I'm just going to forbear it. You know, I'm just going to, you know, I'm just going to, and it just sort of feels good to just sort of let it happen, you know, even though I wish, you know, he were quiet and he is quiet a lot, but, and I just, and I felt, I'm not saying that's why, but I felt really good this morning. It was a beautiful day. It's cool, beautiful breeze. Anyway, that was, but I, you know, I didn't get much sleep, you know, and anyway, it just comes to mind that this might be somehow some unconscious application or something, or maybe more than unconscious. Anyway, I just mentioned it. So that's all.
Wonderful way to hold everybody, not just the orange cat. Simply to allow everybody to be how they are and then to have a sense of delight in how they are, and a sense of curiosity in how they are. When you were a kid, if you had caregivers that were interested in your mind states, they would have asked you about them, and they would have asked you about them often enough that you would have begun to develop the capacity to recognize them and then communicate them to someone else. What's going on with you? I can't tell. What are you angry? Are you happy? Are you excited? Use your words. Tell me what's happening. Edward?
Yeah, real briefly, my mother asked me once when I was about 12 or something, said, "What's wrong, Eddie?" And I said, I said, "I don't know." But it felt so good to have her ask because she never asked.
Right.
Every time I did this like composition on a ukulele or something that we had, and I really, it was like a battle scene or something, and I really wanted her to listen to it, and she was just so busy and worried and that she couldn't. And I guess I probably concluded from that and other things like, well, I don't matter, you know, or something, you know, that was, right. Those are a couple things. Yeah.
Well, that, yeah, that's it. I mean, children, it's an amazing thing. You're a child, and in the beginning, of course, you're entirely dependent on someone else to take care of you and do everything. You can't even roll over, sit up. And then as you develop strength and you can do that, you know, if you've ever been around young kids, they do thousands of little baby crunches to be able to get the body strength, thousands of little baby push-ups until they can get up and creep along the floor and then leg lifts and rolling over. And finally, they're up on all four and they can start crawling around and exploring things and finding things out and come rushing back to the caregiver to show the great discovery, which to the adult mind is not necessarily such a great discovery. It might be cute and all, but it is really just a broken bottle cap or something like that. And then did you have the sensitive enough caregiver who could translate that into something that was meaningful and then radiate out that delight that this child was out in the world discovering things? Or were they distracted and unable to attune? And so the message that is interpreted there is that this doesn't matter. I haven't found something that can interest my caregivers. I can't do that. I'm not interesting. All of those things that cascade from those kinds of experiences. But that's really what I was talking about in terms of the way that we create the realities over and over again so that our preferences don't matter. Even though the initial instruction of that was you know, for me, 68 years ago. Still hanging on to that. Oh my God. But it would be easily just chargeable if you could see how it seeps in to the fabric of how everything's made, everything is interpreted, everything is created. And that's really this investigation that I'm suggesting that we undertake, so that we can see in each of these moments of creation of reality what the old conditioning is, and set that aside and look into the experience of the present moment at all of the possibilities that are there, and then to choose whatever we want from that range of possibilities, to open up the imagination so that it can see them, rather than live with the pinched off aspects where we're excluding from the way that we experience things. Things that we don't believe are possible for us. This is a bittersweet process, of course. The sweetness is if you can open up the experience of the present moment that includes all of the possibilities, you're then free to choose whatever you want. But in doing that, you also understand that often the things that you weren't able to get in your life you didn't get them not because they weren't available to you, but because you didn't feel free to choose them. There's a quality of bitterness in that that makes it sometimes hard to look at. So this process of investigating what a mind state is or what a view is, and then beginning to learn what views are, by how they change the perception of conceptual realities, this exercise. We use loving kindness practice to do that, where we set up the view of loving kindness, this always cool, always kind mind state, and then learn to sustain awareness of it so that we have real agency in how we allow conceptual reality to form. And also agency to change conceptual reality if it arises with an afflictive mind state or view. And to then operate from this place. When we begin this practice using loving kindness, we are focusing on an easy person. And what we mean by an easy person is somebody who, when you think of them, the mind just naturally inclines that way. So there's an absence of desire. It's a coolness. It's kind. It's a consideration without the expectation of return. It's open. There's no rejection. It's friendly, this non-harming stance. It's curious. It's inclining toward. It's engaging toward. It's exuberant in the experience of other people, of the self. It's lively, it's energetic, it's not passive, it's not detached. So then we just begin to think of who that might be that we know that when we think of them, that naturally arises. So it's usually not the people closest to us, because those working models are so complex and there's so many different mindsets associated with them, something easy, something simple. The not many mind states besides that one associated with them, so that when we think of them, the mind naturally inclines that way. The way that we understand our own experience and that we understand who other people are is based on these working models that actually are these compilations of gists that activate. And then we recognize that those complex patterns of activation. A little bit of see, a little bit of hear, a little bit of feel, all coming together in a particular pattern that we then recognize as ourself, or we recognize as someone else. So typically in the beginning, we just let the mind go to see where it lands on an easy person. And then we use the easy person as the to prime the pump, to get the mind state to activate. And then we begin to explore how holding the mind state changes the perception of conceptual reality. This would be in the metta vipassana way of practicing. So you use some of the insight side of practices to explore that. Once you've understood the nature of it, you don't need to continue those explorations. You can just reside in the loving kindness mind. And then we allow the world to be distorted in this beneficial way, in the way that we perceive it. And then we learn to sustain it so that we can have it whenever we want, or as long as we want. That all makes sense. So why don't we do a little practice now and explore that. We'll practice a little bit for the easy person and then attempt to practice for self as well. All right, let go of the meditation. How'd that go?
Oh, that was really good. I have to confess a laziness or something about meditation. It's like work, you know, I see it, you know, but in this case, you know, and then when you were speaking most recently, I was kind of, you know, I was kind of appreciating it, but, you know, not in a regular cognitive way or something. As I said, like agreeing, but I was in a, you know, I transitioned into a, you know, I thought, wow, this really is effective. This could really be effective, you know.
Good.
Even an hour or whatever it is, you know, if I do it, then, you know, it's, I can see how it can be transformative, you know. So anyway.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Mm-hmm.
Someone else? Mm-hmm. All right. So, not this Saturday, but the following Saturday, we have a level one starting. And that'll run for 4 Saturdays from 9 until 1. And then on the 9th of September, which is a Saturday, we're giving a workshop on how to give the adult attachment interview. So if you're curious about that or have some application for it in the work that you do, consider that. We're going to be starting a level 2 in September. Let's see, what is that? September 21st, we're going to do another level 1 in October, starting on the 7th. And then another level 2 starting on the 14th of November. So that's the stuff that's coming up there. If you're interested in it, it's on the website. Take a look. I offer the teaching freely, but I do hope that you'll consider making a donation. There's a link to make a donation on our website, metagroup.org. Any amount is appreciated. It helps support me and also the work Meta Group is doing. Really appreciate your practice. Thanks for coming, and we'll see you soon. Bye now.